Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming this evening. Tonight's speaker needs no introduction, at least not from me, but I'll introduce myself. I'm Scott Metcalf, the music director of Blue Heron, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here this evening for a concert of premieres. Premieres because both of the pieces on our program, John Mason's Ave Fuit Prima Salus and Nicholas Ludford's Mass, Regnum Mundi, which we are doing tonight. No, sorry, it's not that. It's Inclina Cor Meum, Regnum Mundi. That's last year. You should get the CD. This is a different one, Inclina Cor Meum. Both of these pieces have, until our performances this fall, not been sung in North America ever, as far as I can tell. The Mason, certainly not, because it was not complete. It's not been complete for hundreds of years. The notes are practically endless in your program book, and they tell the story of the Peterhouse part books, this set of five books that are the only source for both of the pieces on tonight's program. These are, or were, five books. Each book had one part in it. The soprano part in one book, the alto part in another book, contra in a third book, tenor in a fourth book, and the bass in a fifth book. And the great flaw in that system with manuscript music, of which there is often only one copy, is that if the tenor gets a different job and leaves town and forgets to return his part, you may never see the tenor parts of all the pieces contained in that book again. That's probably not exactly what happened, but somewhere between the time at which these pieces were copied, around 1540, and when we next hear about the part books, the tenor book had disappeared. So it's been gone for centuries, and that means that no one's been able to perform the music in those books, at least those pieces which are only transmitted in those part books, of which there are 40. And Blue Heron's been busy performing a lot of these pieces ever since we started out in 1999 in the reconstructions done by Nick Sandon, an English musicologist who's spent his entire career really working with these part books. He wrote his dissertation on the subject in 1983 and had already recomposed the missing music for his dissertation for almost all of the pieces. And in the time since then, he's been revising his restorations and publishing them. And the Mason, he only finished his new version about a month ago and sent it to us in PDF. So we're actually performing it ahead of its publication. And because when he originally recomposed the missing music 30 years ago, he thought it was a piece for men's voices only, that is to say for low voices, not involving the higher trebles that boys would have sung at the time. Because he, as he now sees it, misconstrued what the original scoring was, the version that he's just completed has really never been sung by anyone before. So it is really, this is a modern-day world premiere. So if you go to a lot of new music concerts, you hear new music all the time, and you know that it's quite difficult on first hearing to form a sensible idea of any piece at all. And these pieces, although they are 500 years old, roughly, do pose many of the same obstacles. None of you will have heard, I expect, very few of you will have ever heard a note of them before, because it's quite a long time ago, and I'm sure no one's quite that old. And unless you maybe have heard us sing it in the last few weeks, this might be your second time. And it's hard to get your head around a brand new piece. So what I'd like to do in this introduction is just suggest some ways in which we can hear brand new music as fully as possible, to hear as much as we possibly can on the first time. And it's a great opportunity because you come to a piece with absolutely no preconceptions whatsoever about that specific piece. Of course, you have a considerable number of preconceptions about music from 1540 in general. Now, since I make a career in music between 1400 and 1750, early music, I often hear from people when I show up at a new music concert and I'm spotted by somebody and they say, "Oh, when was the last time you heard anything from the 20th century?" Or, "Oh, I'm surprised to see you here. How unusual." Which, okay, it's absurd, but it's understandable in a way, and part of the problem, I think, in early music is that we've, through advertising, basically, helped contribute to this idea that early music is somehow set off from the rest of music. And so people who are interested in early music, certainly people who perform it as specialists, must have some primarily historical bent, or they're extraordinarily nerdy about one thing or another, and the music is a little special anyway, and it's not really like real music, which started with Beethoven. I overstate it, but this basic attitude, I tell you, I get this all the time, and I think it's very common. We've all kind of internalized this idea that early music is more peaceful or simple or restful, and of course that's a canard. I think that if you think about it historically, of course, do we really think that human emotion and expression was invented in the early 19th century? Doesn't seem very likely. And of course, we as performers went into this music not because we are primarily nerdy or interested in history or have a very scholastic view of musical performance, but because we thought the music was fantastic, emotionally persuasive, fun to sing, and cool. And that remains true. That's why we're still in it. And I expect that's why you come to concerts too. But I do feel like we should evangelize for a view of music that's much broader than what we normally encounter, which is this idea that sort of the core expressive repertoire is basically from 1800 to 1900. After that, of course, things go completely off the rails. And before that, things were not really like real music in some sense. Coupled to this is the idea that religious music is pious and piety is boring or simple or unidimensional. I think that's another attitude we need to question, because if we think about it, no one really believes that, I don't think. So how are we going to listen to these pieces, though? I think there are a couple ways. One is we want to be able to hear how much variety there is in a piece like Ludford's Mass. Now, it's written, like all the music in the Peterhouse part books, for five voices. In this case, the standard array, a treble part, which would have been sung by boys, the higher boys that had a special treble skill. This is a particularly English accomplishment. Then the next part down, we might call it an alto. They called it the medius, or mean. That is to say, it's sort of the average boy's voice. And the equivalent to that in range, and the voice that could be substituted for a boy in England, is an adult man singing in falsetto, what we would call a countertenor. And Blue Heron has one among our ranks this evening, Martin Neer. He's the guy over here singing between the two women. The third part down is called contratenor. That is not a countertenor in our modern sense, but a part singing against the tenor part, only by this period in a somewhat higher range. But that contratenor sings from C, an octave below middle C, up to F, G, and A's above middle C. It's clearly an adult male tenor who sings high. The fourth part down is the tenor. That's the part that typically holds onto the cantus firmus, or if there's some sort of pre-existent melody. And in the Ludford Mass, there's a little bit of plain chant, which he's taken as the basis for the whole Mass. You'll see it's in your program in notation. It is sung in the course of this Mass 27 times. Everybody gets to sing it except for the means, or the altos, but it's quite undistinguished. It spends a lot of time just sitting on one note, and those notes are sometimes very long. So it doesn't go anywhere particularly. And if it's in a lower part, you may not notice it. You may not notice it in a high part either. The sopranos do sing it quite often as well. There's finally the fifth part is the bass. So one way to create variety right off is to use those five parts not always all at the same time. So there are there's a variety of texture. There are duos between the treble and the contratenor. There are duos between the treble and the bass, then joined by the tenor. There are trios for the top three voices. There are trios for the bottom three voices. There are trios for the middle three voices, then joined by a fourth voice. There are sections in four parts for the top four parts. So Ludford is constantly giving you new things to listen to just in terms of scoring and texture. Each of the four movements of the Mass starts with the same little head motive. I won't sing it for you. You'll hear it right off between the alto or the means and the contratenors. They're on the outside end of our circle. They sing a duet to start, and the beginning of that duet is the same in all four movements, and then it quickly goes off in another direction. So here he's giving you something to learn fast the first time you hear it. So listen very, very carefully, and then you'll hear it again begin the second movement and then go off in another direction. And the Sanctus, again, it's the same music to begin and then off in another direction. And the Agnus Dei, the most surprising direction of all. It's harmonically and melodically different in each case. There is no contrapuntal Kyrie. That's typical of English masses of this period. We'll sing a plain chant Kyrie. It's troped. That is to say, we don't sing Kyrie eleison. We sing a metric Latin text which glosses the Kyrie eleison, and each line does end with eleison as well. Excuse me. It probably will not have escaped your notice that October 11th, just this past Thursday, was the 535th anniversary of the dedication of the book of the Art of Counterpoint by Johannes Tinctoris. But in case it did, and you didn't celebrate it, let me remind you, Tinctoris is a theorist from the northern area of France, near Nivelles. He was born. He was in Cambrai for a while, and he ends up in Naples in the 1470s, working for King Ferrante of Naples, and he was a music tutor to his daughter, Beatrice of Aragon. And Tinctoris wrote a series of treatises, 12 of which survive, sort of laying out all of music theory in the 1470s. It is interesting to me that Tinctoris seems to apply quite well to this music written about 50 years later. England is always marching to a different drummer in one way or another. I mean, they're isolated by the channel, and the medieval era, or the sort of the late 15th century style, seems to have lasted in England well into the 16th century. And that style manifests itself as a kind of irrationality, to borrow the terms of someone who wrote earlier in the 20th century about Achigem and his contemporaries, said that it's irrational because imitation is not used systematically to structure things in the way you might hear in Palestrina, for example, where every phrase, all the parts will start with the same melody, one after the other, interacting this way. In this music, rather, there may be imitation, but it only lasts a moment, and then it's handed around from here to there. So it's used in a much more varied way. So here's another kind of variety, this kind of contrapuntal variety. And Tinctoris tells you this is the most important thing you need to do when you're composing counterpoint. You need to learn all the rules about what's consonant, what's dissonant, where you can place dissonances, how to handle rhythm, and so forth. But this eighth and last rule, he says, is that variety must most accurately be sought for in all counterpoint. For, as Horace says in his Poetics, one who sings to the kithara is laughed at if he always wanders over the same string. Wherefore, according to the opinions of Tullius Cicero, as a variety in the art of speaking most delights the hearer, so also in music a diversity of harmonies vehemently provokes the souls of listeners into delight. Hence the philosopher Aristotle, in his Ethics, does not hesitate to state that variety is a most pleasant thing and human nature in need of it. Now, it's no accident that Tinctoris' authorities here are ancient writers, and writers who are primarily not talking about music, but about oratory, about speech, about persuasive speech, speech that's intended to move and persuade the hearers to put forward ideas and arguments and make them compelling. This is the function of music as well. It's to place a series of ideas before you in the form of sound, and by the combination of sounds and by the sequence of arguments of melodies and ideas and ways of combining melodies and ways of writing one melody against another to give the hearer an emotional experience and draw you in so that you listen to everything that's going on very, very carefully. So this is one way to think about hearing new music, that the composer is actually speaking to you in a way which is trying to get you to listen very carefully. So the composer extends you a hand. I'm going to start each movement with something similar and then go somewhere else. So the careful listener will have noticed the beginning of the Gloria, and then when it comes back for the Credo, we'll say, ah, I know this, but then it goes off in another way. So he's sort of drawing you along. If you're Mason, it's handled a little bit differently, this way of getting your attention. His piece that we'll do tonight is a long poem, which is a great expansion of the salutation of the Archangel Gabriel to Mary. That is, Hail Mary, full of grace, blessed art thou among women. And a 13th century Franciscan took that text and used it word by word. He took the first word, Ave, and then wrote an entire stanza beginning with Ave, which ends Ave Maria. The next one starts with Maria, has a number of other texts, ends Ave Maria. The third one, Ave Maria, Grazia, and there's a stanza beginning with Grazia, then a stanza expanding on that, and it ends Ave Maria, Plena, and so forth. So it's a sort of a gloss. Mason adds to that. He says, I don't want to start with Ave Prima Fuit Salus, because that's a text that doesn't mean anything to anyone. It's not going to draw you in by the ears. So instead, he takes the refrain, as it were, already created by the poet, Ave Maria, and places it at the beginning of the composition as well. And I'll leave you to hear the extraordinary rhetorical gesture with which he gets you to listen to the Ave Maria the very first time. And it's important that you pay very close attention to the Ave Maria the very first time, because that sequence of Ave Marias that recur through the piece, every one is a bead on a rosary or a bead on a meditation bracelet that helps you keep track of where you are and brings your attention back to the music. Because it's 20 minutes long. It's understandable that your attention is going to wander, and the Ave Maria, each one is a way of just saying, excuse me, don't forget to listen to the next passage again. Rhetoric is a very useful way of looking at the composition and the performance of music. If we think of that, a musical performance is analogous to the delivery of a speech. And in classical rhetoric, there are five steps in this process of preparing a speech through delivering it. First, you have to come up with a lot of good ideas. That's the inventio. It actually means to find, you have to discover ideas. So you decide what your ideas and arguments are. Those are the melodies that you're going to use. And then dispositio, how you're going to arrange your melodies, how you're going to arrange your piece, which parts are going to have all five parts singing, which will have reduced textures, how you'll get from one reduced texture to another, how you array the different possibilities through the course of a piece. Sometimes these opportunities are handed to you on a plate. Ave Maria Grazia Plena, the first Ave Maria is for everybody. Then the first stanza beginning Ave Prima Fuit Salus is for the top three parts. The next stanza beginning with Maria and the second stanza will be for the lower three voices. That brings us to Ave Maria Grazia Plena, full, which is an invitation, of course, for all five voices to enter again, and they do. Elocutio is the next step, style, that is to say how your melodies are presented. This is sort of akin to what the relationships will be between your parts, what the intervals are, and how you structure the flow of music. The next step, these are all steps that apply to the composer. This is all the composer's job so far. Tinctoris reminds us that this is also the job of an improviser. But improvisers were allowed a certain amount more freedom, of course, because each improviser is improvising independently. There's not one controlling genius. So now we've got the piece, or the speech. The next step is memoria, to commit it to memory. This is something that I think was probably quite likely, perhaps almost inevitable for secular song. Professionals would almost certainly have memorized things that they were going to go sing at a banquet or at a private function of some kind for their employers. It's less likely, I think, in the case of church music, simply because they were dealing with a lot of repertoire all the time. The repertoire turned over, and you have to sing a mass if you're in an institution that sings a polyphonic mass every week. We actually don't know anything about the amount of rehearsal time devoted to preparation in the 16th century, but it seems likely that they were not able to commit these pieces to memory quite so fast, although undoubtedly they were much, much more adept at it than we are because they were trained to memorize things. The final step, pronunciatio, the delivery. Now finally, after 25 minutes of talking, we've arrived at what we actually do here on stage. And I just want to read some quotes to suggest why we do the kind of things we do, and why music from the 16th century should be as captivating, varied, and expressive as music from any other age. Thus, to be regarded as of the highest judgment are those who, in singing, put all their effort into expressing the words well, when they are of substance, and who make the music accompany them in such a way that the words are the masters, accompanied by servants, so as to appear more honorable. That is to say, music enhances the delivery of text. It goes well beyond that, as we'll see, but that's the first principle. This is Vincenzo Calmetta, goes on to say, not creating the affects and meanings from the music, but rather creating the music from the meanings and the affects of the text. That sounds to us like perhaps a very 17th century, a Baroque attitude, but this is 1504. Here's another one about specific methods, besides paying very close attention to the text and delivering it persuasively and audibly. There's a quote, actually at the end of the program notes, from Morley, who says that one of the principal obligations of the singer is to vowel cleanly and clearly so that the singing will draw the hearer along as if it were by chains of gold to the contemplation of divine things. Here's another. Oh, I have it. There it is. Well, now you've heard it. But here's some more specifics about what we do. Sometimes a composition is performed according to a certain method that cannot be written down, such as uttering softly or loudly, or fast and slow, or changing the speed in keeping with the words so as to show the effects of the passions and the harmony. The measure should change according to the words, now slower, now faster. And again, we'll draw the normal comparison with speech. The experience of the orator can be instructive if you observe the technique he follows in his oration, for he speaks now loud and now soft, now slow, now fast, thus greatly moving the listeners. This technique of changing the tempo has a powerful effect on the soul. And finally, this idea that the words drive everything in music is, of course, a polemic. I don't think that was any truer in the 16th or 17th century than it is nowadays. Words and music are in a partnership. There's a wonderful quote from Deschamps, who's a composer, a poet from the 14th century. And he says words and music are like, this is like a marriage, a union of knowledge and beauty, and one walks with the other and helps the other. That's more like it. I think that was true in the 16th century too. Neither side is really on top. But we do have one great advantage over mere speakers, according to this witness. The poet is not able to present in words the true configuration of the elements which make up the whole, unlike the painter, who can set them before you with the same truth as is possible in nature. The poet may be regarded as equivalent to a musician who sings by himself a song composed for four parts, singing first the soprano, then the tenor, following with the contralto, and then the bass. Such singing cannot result in that grace of proportioned harmony which is contained within harmonic intervals. Alternatively, something made by the poet may be likened to a beautiful face which is shown to you feature by feature, and being made in this way cannot ever satisfactorily convince you of its beauty, which alone resides in the divine proportionality of the said features in combination. Music, in its harmonic intervals, makes its suave melodies, which are composed from varied notes. The poet is deprived of this harmonic option. And although poetry enters the seat of judgment through the sense of hearing, not by reading, note, through hearing, like music, the poet is unable to describe the harmony of music because he has not the power to say different things at the same time. On account of this, the poet remains far behind the painter with respect to the representation of corporeal things, and with respect to invisible things, he remains behind the musician. Leonardo da Vinci. It's nice to be patted on. If you're a musician, this is nice to hear from a witness of such prominence. I'm running a little over, which, of course, I never let the other pre-concert speakers do. But I just want to say this is the kind of thing that polyphony, 16th century polyphony, does that some other music doesn't even do, which is to say it allows people to say different things all at the same time. So we're five parts. Each part is absolutely equal to the others in importance. Each part pursues its own melody, its own ideas, its own argument, its own flow of beauty, but at the same time, it's conversing with all the others. It's like being at a big family banquet in an Italian family, where everyone speaks at the same time. But they're not oblivious in any way to the speech of the other participants in the discussion. They're able to hear the counter-argument or the new idea being presented even at the same moment as they are refuting it or presenting their own new ideas. This is what we can do. You hear each independent melody, and yet they speak to each other. And it's a challenge to hear that all at once. So all the best with these premieres. Thank you.